So good morning and welcome to the Doorsteps podcast. We're going to be talking about affordable housing issues in Ohio and beyond here on Doorsteps. So my name is Dr. Cody Price, and I would like to introduce you all to my very first guest, Michelle Norris.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you for coming in. Michelle is the Executive Vice President of External Affairs and Strategic Initiatives at National Church Residences, as well as the President of National Church Residences Investment Corporation. National Church Residences is an innovative leader in housing, healthcare, and other supportive services for seniors and families. Michelle guides them in their mission towards greater focus, impact, and investment. Her primary responsibilities include mission expansion and impact, public policy, community affairs, communications, and public relations. And so I've asked Michelle to provide an overview of what affordable housing is, what it is not, and what's in store for the future of affordable housing, so that we're really all here on the same page. And so to cover these topics, we've decided to discuss them through a series of five myths of affordable housing. And so for the first myth that we're going to be discussing is that affordable housing is mostly high-rise projects in poor neighborhoods.
Definitely a myth. So I would say that this is probably one of the biggest stereotypes that we hear is people have this image of the high-rise projects is how they would call them, that were some of the first public housing structures that were built. They were built in the 60s. There's been so many different varieties of affordable housing that have been built since then. In many ways, you almost need a dictionary to have a definition of all the different terms and different types of affordable housing. I can name a few. Of course, we call it public housing or PHA. There's tenant-based vouchers. There is rental assistance. There's Section 8. There's HUD 202s. There's the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. Those are just some of them. And if I were somebody who didn't understand housing, I would simply take the one or two times that I've touched housing, and that would become my impression. Mm-hmm. And so often people don't really know what it is. And it's complicated because there's so many varieties of it. So I think that does lead us to a lot of stereotyping or generalizations. And often those are not in the best of lights. So I think it's really important that those of us who understand the industry continue to help people who don't get exposed to it, to explain it, to show it, and to really help people to personalize it in a way that makes it different than the stereotypes.
Yeah, and so, I mean, as of right now, what is probably the most prominent affordable housing program? Like, what are the definitions of affordable housing?
Sure.
Who are we serving?
So there is probably, I would call it two different buckets of housing, well, maybe three buckets of housing. Two are run by the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs, HUD, it's a federal program that's been out there since the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it was divided into two groups. The first group is the group that is run by HUD working with private owners. And then there's another where they work with public housing authorities, which are quasi-governmental agencies that are located all over the country. Then there's a third bucket, which is the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. It's a younger bucket. It was started in 1986, as opposed to in the 60s. It is probably the most prevalent way of producing housing today. And it is not run by HUD. It is run actually from the IRS. I know, go figure. And the IRS actually then gives the authority and the funding to the state agencies. And so every state agency is a recipient of funds that they then can use to produce housing. So in some ways, you would say they went from a federally driven program that HUD did to a more state-driven program that the state agencies, the state housing agencies, will then do. In Ohio, it's called OFA. And so that's kind of how we now do new production. So if you look at those three buckets, I'd say in general, it's about a third of the units that we have in this country are in each of those buckets. They all have their own rules. They all have their own eligibility requirements. And so, again, going back to the first comment, trying to explain to somebody who doesn't understand housing, well, over in this property, you have to make 30% of the area medium income. In this one, you have to make 50%. In this one, you can make up to 60%. You lose people on that first beginning of the conversation. So the easiest way to say it, I think, is in each of these, we are trying to ensure that people don't make too much money to live in these communities. Mm-hmm. How much can they make? It depends on each property. But in the end, we're trying to target communities for people that have less than the area median income.
Thank you. And so moving on to our second myth that we're going to be discussing is just that low-income housing programs do not really target those who need it most. So we were kind of talking about this in the first myth, but just kind of delving further into getting more of the LIHTC program, kind of talking about these population changes or percentage changes, looking at those that are severely cost burdened or cost burdened. So kind of just talking about.
Sure. So I think when Congress moved from HUD-based housing to the tax credit program, one of the reasons they did that was there was a lot of pushback in communities that we were creating housing for the poor. And we were, you know, those horrible words. We were warehousing the poor. We were segregating the poor. We were putting the poorest of the poor in one building, big high rises. You know, it's every myth you ever hear. The tax credit program, in many ways, I think, responded to some of those myths. And so it allows people to go up to 60% of the area median income. So for many people, that is working basically a minimum wage job or something even higher than that, and you can still live in a tax credit housing. That's the good news. The bad news is that the shortage of housing is actually even more acute in our lower income group. So our extremely low income residents or people who need housing actually have fewer options than those people at the 60% level. So tax credit, the low-income housing tax credit program, as it exists just all by its lonesome, is not really a poverty-solving program. It is a workforce-solving program. The nice thing about the tax credit program is it's incredibly flexible. So you can take that base program and you can add on additional constraints so that you might say, we want this to house people from all incomes, from the extremely low income all the way to the lower income. So a whole bracket of folks. And so as you design each building, you can kind of customize it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so you can try to serve as many of those income bands as possible without the folks that are really could afford to pay a market rent. So it's a lovely program in that it's so flexible. The downside of the program, again, is that it's so complicated that people just can't quite figure out exactly what it is. But I will say that because it allows the flexibility, it is harder in the tax credit program to target the lowest income client. So your question of does it really, you know, solve or meet the need of everybody? It's harder to meet the need of the lowest income people. Well, why is that? Well, basically, it's hard to finance. For every time you go lower and lower into the poverty side of the continuum, let's say, it becomes more expensive because you have to have more subsidy to cover what that client can't pay. So a 60% client might be able to pay $200 more a month than that client who is in the poverty level. So it's because of that continuum and the harder, and it's harder to finance on the lower end that we say we have to be very careful not to forget that part. So right now, there is a national study, and I think this is a pretty compelling argument of why we need to keep looking and making sure we keep pushing the tax credit program to solve into the lowest poverty. And that is that right now in the 50%, what they call area median income group, there are 56 units for every 100 renters. Still not enough, right. Way not enough. But if you're in the 30%, so if you're even more in the poverty level, it's 35 units for every 100 residents that are, or I'm sorry, for every 100 renters that is looking for an apartment. So one out of every three people will find an apartment. So it really compels us to continue to focus the tax credit program on hitting all parts of that continuum, not just the 60 percenters. I know that's a lot of technical terms, but I hope that puts it in a way that's a little bit easier to follow.
Yeah. And I mean, even with that, it's just like, it's hard to, I mean, you say one in three, but it's like, but how many of those ones actually get housing? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, we want to make sure that we are providing them with this, but voucher wait lists are extremely long. Mm-hmm. I know that's kind of, some LIHTC programs like allow Section 8 in there. And so it's just, how do we really deal with this issue of like over demand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a really, well, I would say that's like a $1 billion question. It is all about money and public will. Right now, we are probably in one of the most acute affordable housing crises that I've ever seen in my career. It is as the rents are going up everywhere across the country, it is becoming acute everywhere. Almost every mayor in a major city is now speaking of the affordable housing crisis. And that is new. You know, we just talked earlier about many people don't really pay much attention to affordable housing. Suddenly, people are paying a lot more attention because it's so short. And for instance, not long ago, there was a group called AHCA that was created. National Church Residences is a member, which is the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. And it was created probably maybe 5 years ago because of the shortage becoming so much more acute. And so a whole group of folks got together and said, let's understand better what the facts are. Is it really that much shorter, or are we just seeing it more? I mean, are we just perceiving it, or is it just an awareness thing? So some statistics that came out of that group, I think, are pretty compelling.
And so you're kind of talking about these issues about affordable housing, getting at who is actually needing the housing and things like that. And so it kind of brings us into our myth number three, which is affordable housing is an entitlement. And so can you just kind of explain more about who is actually receiving affordable housing, who is accessing it, and who is eligible?
Sure. Cody, I think this is one of the biggest myths that has surprised me in my career. I spent a lot of time, I'm actually a runner, and so I run with a lot of folks that have nothing to do with affordable housing. It's incredibly therapeutic, and to not have to talk about affordable housing everywhere. But what has surprised me is that number of people think that affordable housing is like, let's say, Medicaid. Medicaid is a health insurance program for those who are in the poverty level. If you are in poverty, you qualify for Medicaid for the most part. There is no such thing as a wait list. You qualify, you get it. In affordable housing, it is not an entitlement, so to speak, like Medicaid. There is a certain amount of stock, and there are a certain amount of people who want into those units. And there are a lot more people than there are units. And there is no program policy commitment that we're going to build enough units that will meet how many people need it. It's not just how many people want it. It's how many people totally qualify for it. Right. And so this is a different thing. And I think people are surprised by that. They think, oh, gosh, if somebody's in poverty, surely we provide them an affordable unit. We don't. As a country, we don't do that. And so the shortage is getting more acute. And that is something we've become incredibly aware of. We hear it talked about more at mayoral conferences, at governor conferences. We hear it talked about on political campaigns. And we sat back along with some of our colleagues not long ago and said, is this just our perception or is it really getting worse? And so there was, for instance, a group in Ohio called AHCA, which is called the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio. And it's a group of developers, operators, folks that are just really interested in this issue of affordable housing, got together. And the first thing we did was commission a study to try to understand how bad is the problem. And that's, you know, before you try to solve it, you got to understand the problem.
Right.
And so the group got together and we did a study, and some statistics that came out of that I think are incredibly scary and compelling. Let me just give you a couple of them.
Sure.
One is one that I think you mentioned, which is there's only one unit for every three people in poverty. So going back to, is it an entitlement? Clearly not. If there are three people for every unit, it's not an entitlement. Another one is that we actually have a poverty problem that is growing faster than the population as a whole. And so in Central Ohio, the growth of people in poverty has grown three times faster than the population as a whole. That's stunning.
Yeah.
It's very scary. Right now in the Central Ohio region, we have a housing authority and they have people that are allowed to use vouchers so that they can go to an apartment and say, I have this voucher, it's a coupon, it's going to pay part of my rent and I'll pay the difference. That's a great coupon. However, right now the wait list to get one of those coupons is 17,000 households. Not people, 17,000 households. I mean, you could wait on that wait list. I mean, why would you even go on the wait list? Just you're going to be there until you retire. Mm-hmm. And another one that's really near and dear to my heart is the growth of the senior population is currently growing 6 times the population in general in Central Ohio. And many, many of those seniors are fixed income in the lower and extremely lower income brackets. So going back to your question, is it a myth? It is absolutely a myth that it's an entitlement. We have a crazy shortfall, and it's really, that's not just in Central Ohio. I've been in Atlanta where it was a major platform of the mayor, of the new mayor. I've heard about it in Austin, Texas. I've heard about it in San Francisco. I've heard about it in New York City. I've heard about it in Toledo, Ohio. Right. It's everywhere. So it's a very important myth to talk about. So thank you for bringing it up.
Of course. Thank you for talking about it. Moving on to our fourth myth that we will be discussing, which is you can't beat NIMBY. And so I think this plays most dear to my heart because that's what my research is all about. Stigma, perception of affordable housing, looking at those that are really against affordable housing coming into their neighborhood, mm-hmm. and these individuals really being calling the NIMBYists, mm-hmm. Which stands for not in my backyard.
Right, right. So, correct. NIMBY is not in my backyard, and it has been out there forever. But there have been a lot more power given to the NIMBY movement, I think, over the years. And a lot of that is because politics is local, and so is affordable housing development. In the end, the state agency can foster and encourage and ask communities to welcome affordable housing, but there are certain things that have the power is local that can be used to stop that affordable housing. For instance, one of them, which is big, is zoning. Zoning requirements, which are very, very local. You can have a zoning department in every single suburb. So in the Central Ohio region, for instance, in addition to the Columbus Zoning Department, Westerville will have its own zoning department, Upper Arlington will have its own zoning department, Gahanna will have its own. And each one of them has the rules by which anybody can develop, and you have to go to them and get your approvals. So there have been a lot of studies, and I'm sure you've probably done some of them, about how zoning can become so constrained that it can really discourage the ability to build affordable. One of those is that density. Mm-hmm. It's expensive to build broad. Right. So if you build a single home on an acre lot, that's expensive. If I build 5 units on that same acre lot, per unit is going to be cheaper than if I build one house. And so there are lot of areas where they will say, your lot can't have more density than this per acre. And that really puts constraints on the affordability opportunities. So that's an example, is that kind of the regulatory side. Another side, of course, is the myth. So the myth of affordable housing, that affordable housing will bring in those people, mm-hmm. that it will devalue our property values. And those are really hard to push back on. There have been more and more studies that have come out now that we have length of ability to study things, where it is really said that affordable housing doesn't bring down property values, right. very specifically. Mm-hmm. And being able to get that out against the perception is so important. And so those studies have been incredibly valuable. So those are some things that can help against that. Another thing that we've seen is social media has not been a fan to helping break down those barriers.
Yes.
Social media is so fast, and it is often neighborhood driven, that it's possible for neighborhoods to get out a lot of not accurate information before we're able to go out and share what's real. Mm-hmm. And so that's been something that we've had to recalibrate how we think about community engagement. So that's all true about NIMBYism. What is not true is that you can't break NIMBYism. If done well, it is possible to break it. And I'll just give you 3 suggestions. I can't promise, it's no guarantee, but it is the fact that NIMBYism can bring out the best in people and it can bring out the worst in people. Mm-hmm. But because it can bring out the best, you really need to look at where are those people that are the best people. And so our organization does several things. The first is we start by doing a lot of pre-community engagement. So if we go to a community anymore, we don't start by saying, hi, here we are, and here's the site plan, and we're done. Welcome to the neighborhood. Welcome us to the neighborhood. We start by saying, this is what we're thinking of doing. This is potentially some of the renderings we have, and we try to engage the community. Let them have a say in what we're trying to do before we, quote unquote, cook the whole project. The second thing we do is we look for a local champion. There are often people right in the community that have a strong sense that affordable housing is a good thing, or that there are people right in the community that so struggle, and that having that affordable housing would be good for the people right in their neighborhood. And so they can be your champ. And the third thing is, and this is really important, find a political champ. Sometimes it's the mayor. Sometimes it's the city council. Sometimes it might be a state legislator. But somebody needs to be very important in saying, this is a good priority and we believe in it. So finding those kind of ingredients can really help. Can't guarantee, because some cases are stronger than others, but working on those regs is important. So continuing that great research to break down that those perceptions is really helpful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and so moving on to our fifth myth, which we were kind of bringing it up with this NIMBYism, but really the only people who are benefiting from affordable housing are thugs and hooligans.
I'm sorry. I love that one. It's a great myth and it's really, really wrong. But it is a hard one to break. Again, I have found so often that I will take people, I will get them in my car, whether it's a state legislator or it's somebody who runs a business. And I say, how often do you visit affordable housing? Well, pretty usually it's never. And so you take them out to communities, and I'm very proud because my organization does a lot of affordable housing, and I love hearing people say, I didn't know this was affordable.
Yes.
And that is the light bulb. It is the light bulb that gets people to change their mind. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing that gets people to change their mind better than letting them touch and feel it. So I think that's probably the best thing to do, is to humanize it, let people come out and see it. And don't be afraid to take the time to get people out there.
Yeah. And so kind of what we were previously talking about, just kind of who affordable housing is really serving. And it's just seniors are a major part of those who are benefiting. And just how fast are we aging? That, I mean, you were kind of bringing it up before, but it's just how, like, for people that are benefiting from affordable housing, how important are seniors for this population?
Right. So seniors is such a unique group in that they're not only in need of the affordable housing, but they're a growing number compared to the population whole. We talked about that earlier. 6 times in Central Ohio, they're growing 6 times faster than the regular population, than the rest of the population. That can be, as a friend of mine said, very scary, but it can be a great opportunity as well. It can be a great opportunity for us to really help those who have spent their life doing good work and are now ready to retire, and they're ready to retire in a community that they lived in their whole life. Often what we see is that people that have lived in its suburbs as well as the central city, they have worked and lived and they've lived in a house. They are now at a point where they are retired, they're aging, the house is too big, it's too hard to keep up. They want to go into an apartment. Something small, something where they don't take care of their snow removal or their roof. Yeah, I never liked the idea of my 75-year-olds on the ladder. There's some of them do, and some of them are quite capable, but not everybody should be climbing up on a ladder onto their roof at 75. So moving into something like an apartment is a great idea. But the amount of folks that we know that have said, I had to move out of my house in Worthington or Arlington or Gahanna and move someplace else because there wasn't any affordable housing apartment options for me that were, you know, really conducive to me as a senior. They are 3 and 4 bedrooms, or they're in the middle of a, you know, residential community that doesn't really fit my needs, and so they need to move. So I think they are one of the most compelling groups. Obviously, I think so. It's what I do for a living, but I think they're one of the most compelling groups that are in need, because as we talk about that acute shortfall, well, that group, that acute shortfall, is getting more acute every single day. There's a conversation that you often hear people say, that there are 10,000 seniors turning 65 every day for the next 20 years. Now, I've, in all disclosure, I've heard some people say it's 8,000, not 10,000. You know what? 8,000 or 10,000, that's a lot of people every day turning 65. And that means there are also a lot of people turning 85. Mm-hmm. And so the difference between a 65-year-old and an 85-year-old in terms of their housing needs, there's just more and more and more of both of those groups happening. And so we have to be thinking about them and regarding this acute shortage of affordable housing.
Oh, thank you. Yes. And we'll be getting more into the senior housing on our next podcast. So great. Tune in then. And so wrapping things up kind of for this first podcast. So after everything that we've really discussed today, going through these five myths of affordable housing, you talking about them not being myths. So what are the major facts or facts in general that you wish that everyone could kind of know about affordable housing?
So the first one is the one that we talked about earlier around entitlements. It is not an entitlement. The fact is that there is a tremendous amount of shortfall of housing units compared to the people who need it. That's really important for people to understand. It is a national problem, and that is a fact. The second fact is that affordable housing is helpful for a variety of people, and many are your neighbors, your family members, your colleagues. Often it's the person who works with you. It's your favorite barista. It is the person who is your favorite clerk at the grocery store. It is your handyman that comes to your house and you trust. And those people often are the ones who are struggling to make ends meet. And affordable housing is the solution for folks to have better quality of life and that they deserve. They're working people who deserve a same quality of life than somebody who makes more money. Mm-hmm. So that's the second one. And the third one would be the fact is that there are unintended consequences of not having affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And this goes down to a personal level. And I'll give you an example on the senior level. The unintended consequences of somebody having to pay too much rent is that they are now fixed income. They may be living on Social Security. They're paying too much for their rent. Let's say up to 75% of their income is going just to put a roof over their head, leaving them 25% of their income every month to pay for two big things, food and medication. And as they age, they may need more meds. And that means that at that 25%, they're going to start shorting themselves food or they're going to start shorting their meds. And we see it all the time. People who can't afford their meds because they're spending too much on their rent. So that's an example of unintended consequences, of social consequences, as well as personal consequences of this shortfall, the fact of the shortfall.
Oh, thank you. And so one thing that we're going to be doing on this podcast is that I'm going to be asking all the speakers to give a book recommendation. And so if you could suggest one book that you would like our listeners to read, what book would that be and why?
I love books, and there are so many great books. But a book that really, when I was young in my career, really was compelling to me is a book called Nickeled and Dimed. And it's by a lady named Barbara Ehrenreich. And her book, there's several books that have come after that that have also been very compelling. One was called Paycheck to Paycheck. And then there was another one called Evicted, which is kind of in today's era where Nickeled and Dimed was probably 10 or 15 years ago. It was such a compelling book. In this book, she is an undercover journalist and goes to different places in the country. I remember she went to Bangor, Maine, and she went down to Florida, and I think she went to Wisconsin. And she tried to make it on a minimum wage job. And it just put me in her shoes. And she was putting herself in the shoes of somebody who is living on minimum wage. And it is unbelievably compelling how hard it is to live that way, how much stress it puts you on, how much any surprise throws you off. Your car breaks down and suddenly you can't get to work. And having it in a book like that really helps your sense of this could be me, but mm-hmm. for. And I think it's a great book.
Well, thank you for your suggestion. I'll have to check it out myself. And so thank you so much, Michelle, for coming in and speaking to us about the five myths of affordable housing. As I was mentioning before, I look forward to our second part of our conversation. We'll be discussing senior affordable housing more in details and ways that National Church Residences fulfills this role. For our listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops podcast so you don't miss any updates about affordable housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Thank you so much.
Thank you.